This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. This is Earth Matters on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. Richard Heinberg is an American journalist and educator specialized in energy, economic, and ecological issues. A senior fellow at the Post Carbon Institute, Richard is considered one of the world's foremost advocates for a shift away from our current reliance on fossil fuels. He joins me now on the line from the US to discuss realistic avenues for transitioning to renewable energy, the environmental implications of economic growth, and how we can build more resiliency into the sustainability movement. Welcome, Richard. So, Richard, like I mentioned, you are regarded as one of the world's foremost advocates. What got you interested in renewable energy and sustainability?
Well, I've had a long-standing interest in understanding how societies change over time. Mm-hmm. And in the 1990s, I somehow stumbled across a piece of information I had been missing up to that point. And that was the role of energy in human societies. I guess previously I had assumed that most social change was brought about by politics or economics. But really, the way we get our energy determines just about everything else. If we get our energy from hunting and gathering wild foods, we're likely to have a certain kind of society. If we get our energy from growing crops and harvesting biomass, we're likely to have a certain kind of society. Mm-hmm. Well, since a couple of hundred years ago, we've been getting our energy from fossil fuels, and mm-hmm. it's really changed everything. Yeah. We're able to increase our consumption or use of energy many, many times over. And that enabled us to grow our economies, to invent all kinds of energy-using technologies to transport us, to manufacture more stuff, to move our stuff around, to harvest resources at higher rates and more cheaply, mm-hmm. Everything from fishing vessels to chainsaws and on and on and on. It changed human society more than anything else has ever done. But of course, it was kind of a bargain with the devil, because these fuels, these fossil fuels, coal, oil, and natural gas, are non-renewable. They're depleting. That means that using them is inherently unsustainable. But also, as we burn them, they pollute air and water. And they're also changing the very chemistry of the atmosphere and oceans via climate change and ocean acidification. Mm-hmm. So we're really involved in history's biggest science experiment. And I would say it's a pretty reckless experiment, and we're betting everything that somehow this experiment comes out okay, and there won't be, any really serious consequences of our dependence on fossil fuels, and that we'll somehow be able to shift off of fossil fuels to something else mm-hmm. easily and quickly and cheaply. And both of those bets, in my mind, after studying these questions very deeply for many years, both of those assumptions, I think, are very questionable.
I guess it goes to that quote that you once said in an interview: on a finite planet, nothing grows forever.
Right. And, economic growth is something we all take for granted these days. Mm-hmm. But it's really something that governments have come to rely on, really just since World War II. The 20th century was really the century of coal and oil and natural gas, much more so than the previous century. And as a result, economies were able to expand in ways and to degrees that were completely unheard of before. So we started to rely on economic growth to produce more jobs, to create more revenue for governments, to produce more income for investors and so on. All of this seemed very good. And particularly since population was growing very rapidly during this time, we needed lots of jobs. We needed more government services and so on. And so we came to believe that somehow economic growth was normal and natural, and that we should expect it to happen forever and ever. And of course, as you just said, you know, that's a pretty peculiar belief, because prior to the fossil fueled industrial revolution, economies really didn't grow. We had kind of cyclical economies that expanded for a while and then they would contract. Civilizations would rise and fall and so on. That's what people were used to. That's what they expected. But now we're just in this completely different world. And because it's been going on for as long as most of us have been alive, we think it's normal, and it's not.
Yeah, and you know, just looking around us, I mean, humanity is clearly living beyond sustainability limits now. So I guess, is it vital to change course? And if so, how?
Well, it's really vital that we change course about 4 or 5 decades ago. But unfortunately, that option is no longer available to us. There's an organization called the Global Footprint Network, and they keep track of how much humanity is using in the way of basic resources compared to what the Earth can sustainably provide on an annual basis.
Yeah.
And it turns out we're using about 60% more on an annual basis than Earth is able to sustainably provide. So we're using 1.6 Earth's worth of resources right now. The only way we can do that is by drawing down resources that future generations would otherwise need. We in the industrialized world are using resources at such a rate that if everyone were to live the way we're living, we'd need something like 4 or 5 planets.
Yeah.
Obviously, we don't have 4 or 5 planets. So, but that's just an index of how unsustainably we are using Earth's resources right now. Clearly, this can't go on for much longer. And I'm not suggesting that I or anyone else has some kind of blueprint for exactly when all of this is going to turn into a big crisis and civilization will collapse and so on. Mm-hmm. I don't know that. Nobody does. But it's clear. I mean, when previous human civilizations overused their resources, the results were not pretty. And, you know, we could talk about the Mayans and the Romans and the ancient Sumerians and Greeks and what happened to them, how they overused their resources and so on. But, you know, it's about time we learned this lesson.
Scientists are saying, and I think I'm sure you believe in this as well, that we are living in the Anthropocene now.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, it's funny or it's ironic that, you know, we're not only driving global warming and ecological destruction, we know that we are. But tragically, you know, it's only by despoiling the planet that we've actually realized just how much a part of it we are.
Well, it's interesting that it's as we have developed this unsustainable mode of being on the planet, economic growth, dependence on fossil fuels, rapid population growth, and so on. It's at the same time we've been doing that we have also developed the science of ecology, which mm-hmm. is the study of the relationship between organisms and their environment. And we do understand these relationships between organisms and between human beings and natural resources far, far better than people in any previous society or any previous century.
Mm-hmm.
So we have the knowledge, we have the scientific understanding. What's lacking is our applying that understanding and that information to our real situation. And of course, people have been talking about this, especially since the 1970s. You know, the environmental movement has formed and diversified, and there are all kinds of NGOs now talking about climate change and population and all of these other issues. But that discussion hasn't really changed the overall operating system of global industrial civilization, and that's what needs to happen.
Yeah, because I think part of what's so uncomfortable, I guess, about this is that our individual acts, I mean, statistically and morally, they may seem very insignificant, but actually when you multiply them, you know, millions, billions of times even, right, as they are performed by an entire species, you know, that's almost like a collective act of, I don't know, ecological destruction. I don't know if you agree with that.
Well, yes. And, you know, each of us is basically just following the cultural cues,
yeah,
that are set out in front of us. I mean, you know, if you live in an American suburb, it's very difficult to get around without a car. So mm-hmm. if you know, live in a suburb and you want to have a job and your kids want to go to school and so on, well, you sort of have to buy into all of these expected ways of living, and people just, you know, accept these as a natural part of life. But, you know, when you step back and look at the situation, people in, say, North America or Australia are using resources at many, many times the rate of people in other parts of the world, say, sub-Saharan Africa. A typical North American is using 100 times as much energy as a typical sub-Saharan African. Mm-hmm. So we're all involved in this, but some of us are a little more involved than others, let's say.
Yeah. Do you think now then we must now learn to live without growth? I mean, is that something that we should all aspire to?
Well, it's going to happen one way or another. And it is happening fairly slowly right now. If you look at a chart of rates of global economic growth, or a chart of the rate of economic growth for the United States, for example, you'll see very clearly that the highest rates of growth occurred immediately after World War II and up through the 1960s. Mm-hmm. Since that time, world economic growth has generally been slowing. Of course, a few nations like China, for example, have seen very, very rapid growth over the past couple of decades, partly as a result of people in the United States and Europe and other countries sort of outsourcing their manufacturing to the Chinese for various reasons. But even with that factored in, the reality is that growth is slowing. And there are very good reasons for that. We've reached the point of diminishing returns with regard to a lot of things that we were doing that led to that very rapid economic growth. For example, with fossil fuels, we've gotten to the point where the easy and cheap stuff is gone. It's not as though we're actually running out of coal or oil or natural gas. There's lots left. But we've harvested these fuels using the low-hanging fruit principle. Mm-hmm. So that means we target the cheapest to get oil, coal, and natural gas first, and leave the nasty, dirty, hard to get, expensive stuff for later.
Yeah.
Well, with regard to all of these fuels, it's getting to be later. And so the costs of exploration and production in these industries are rising. And that, it's a classic instance of, as I said a moment ago, the law of diminishing returns. We just don't get as much bang for the buck as we did a few decades ago. We've also tried to keep growth going through increasing debt and what's called financialization. Mm-hmm. The amount of government debt that's been accumulated over the last few decades, completely unprecedented, but also consumer debt, household debt. And we do this, again, to stoke growth. We've become dependent on economic growth, and if we borrow now, so that we can consume now and pay later, well, that stokes more growth. But if you build up too much debt within the economy, either government debt or household debt, eventually you get to the point where folks can't make the payments on the debt they already have, and the bank doesn't want to loan them any more money. So we kind of got to that point in 2008.
Yes.
With the global financial crisis. And since then, the central banks of the United States, China, Europe, and elsewhere have really stepped in with extraordinary policies of very low interest rates and massive money creation to kind of keep the party going just a little bit longer. We'll see how long this lasts, but it's clear that the economic growth that we saw in the past few decades is winding down, and we better get ready for something else. What's coming next? It's going to be a different kind of economy, and the outlines of it are already starting to become pretty plain.
And what is that future economy that you foresee happening, or that you hope will happen?
Well, those are partly two different questions, unfortunately. I think the most likely scenario would be one in which our current economic system just frays and collapses, simply because we haven't foreseen what's coming, and we don't have the institutions in place to keep our basic support systems going, mm-hmm. as debt unwinds and as our growth-based economic system runs into the end of growth. But what could happen is a transition to a post-growth economy where we no longer require our institutions to grow. For example, we've created as really our hallmark economic institution, the publicly traded corporation. And the corporation has to grow or die. It's either gaining market share or it's losing market share. It's either satisfying shareholders or the shareholders are bailing out. Companies don't have to operate that way. We could provide for basic human needs by way of cooperative enterprises, worker-owned enterprises that don't continually have to grow, whose main objective, rather than providing increasing shareholder value, would be to provide good jobs for workers and good products for customers. There are already, of course, you know, thousands and thousands of companies that fit this description, this model, mm-hmm. and they're quite successful. I think they will be much less vulnerable to the end of growth than the standard publicly traded corporation. So that's just one example. But, you know, we're going to have to rethink banking, public banking rather than private banks that depend on charging interest on loans to make profits for shareholders. We're going to have to rethink work itself. You know, maybe there really aren't going to be enough jobs for everyone. So how do we keep society working if we don't have jobs for everyone? Maybe we need to have job sharing programs, or maybe we need a universal basic income. There are a lot of ideas floating around among the few economists who actually do understand this situation, people like the Australian economist Steve Keen, who's one of the most forward-thinking of the world's economists on these issues.
But you know, how realistic is all of this? I mean, because basically you're talking about a whole change of mindset and a whole change of, you know, of business as we know it, for lack of a better phrase. How realistic do you think this is?
Well, unfortunately, at this point, I think it's unrealistic to think that all of these changes are going to happen voluntarily and without some kind of crisis.
Yeah.
If we had started working in this direction back in the 1970s and 80s, as a few forward-thinking environmentalists were proposing, then I think we could have avoided the kind of crisis that's now headed our way. And it's a crisis that will be ecological and economic in character. Now, it's also true, however, that crisis can create opportunities for change that perhaps weren't so obvious beforehand. Mm-hmm. Looking back to the global financial crisis of 2008, we saw people starting to question capitalism, questioning our banking institutions, questioning derivatives, all sorts of things that everyone was taking for granted just 6 months before. Suddenly, everything was up for debate. And I think we're approaching a time that may be, you know, like that global financial crisis, only in this instance, I think it's not likely to be so easily solved. And it might be more profound in character than occurred last time. it seems as though every time we have one of these financial cycles, it's worse. You know, we had the dot-com bubble back in the late 1990s, and that was pretty terrible. But then the GFC in 2008 was much worse than that. I think we're going to see that cycle come around again, probably fairly soon, within the next 2, 3, 4 years, something like that. And we should put our thinking caps on ahead of time and start thinking now about the kinds of institutions and changes that could be proposed, because we may not have that much time to respond. So the more good ideas we have waiting in the wings to take off the shelf when the time arrives, the better off we'll be.
I'm speaking today to Richard Heinberg. He's a journalist and educator and a senior fellow at the Post-Carbon Institute. And we're discussing realistic avenues for transitioning to renewable energy, among many other things. Coming out after this quick break, we find out more about Richard's work through the Post-Carbon Institute. You are listening to Earth Matters on the Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. This is Earth Matters on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Julia Jacobs. Joining me on the line from the US today is Richard Heinberg. He is a journalist and educator specialized in energy, economic, and ecological issues. And he's also a senior fellow at the Post-Carbon Institute.
So I just want to talk now about the Post-Carbon Institute, which you are an integral part of. Maybe you can tell me a little bit about the Institute and how you got involved with the institution and what it stands for.
Yeah, well, the Post-Carbon Institute, as the name suggests, is a think tank that looks at our dependence on fossil fuels, the unsustainability of that dependence, and how society can change that. It was incorporated as an NGO, a nonprofit organization, back in 2003. And very soon, the founders of Post-Carbon Institute contacted me and asked me to be on the board of the organization. And I have been on the board of PCI, I think, ever since. But then back in 2007, I was asked to become a senior fellow on staff at the organization, and I very happily accepted that invitation. So I've been on full-time staff for about 10 years now. And we have an office now in Corvallis, Oregon. I don't live in Corvallis myself. I live in Santa Rosa, California. We have some staff who are working in Mexico, in the UK, and elsewhere. So we're kind of, you know, scattered around, but our main office is in Oregon.
Blessings of, I suppose, Wi-Fi and good internet connections.
That's right. And so we do a lot of, as a think tank, we do a lot of analysis and publication. We have done, I think, the best analytical work out there on the subject of hydrofracturing or fracking, mm-hmm. and the economics and geology of fracking, as well as the environmental impacts. And if you go to our website, you can easily find those reports on shale gas and tight oil, and also you'll find links to our report on the transition to renewable energy called Our Renewable Future, mm-hmm. and just lots and lots of other stuff. We published books and reports by the armload since we've been around. So there's a lot there to read.
So just looking at the focus on transitioning to renewable energy, I mean, oil, gas and coal, they still account, I think, for about 86% of the energy keeping the world's lights on, you know, cars running, homes warm, those sorts of things. A share that I think has barely changed in 25 years. And you know, coal and gas fired power plants are still being built, you know, especially in places like here, the developing world, where, you know, 1.2 billion people still lack electricity. Do you think there is a shift, though, to clean power, and has that begun, and has that even begun to accelerate, would you think?
Well, yes, it has begun, and it is accelerating. Unfortunately, at this point, the amount of new solar and wind power added on an annual basis is not enough to keep up with the overall growth in energy usage.
Right.
So we're not really making the transition at a sufficient speed. There are a lot of challenges with the transition to renewable energy. Of course, we are advocates at Post-Carbon Institute of renewable energy. But at the same time, we like to think of ourselves as realists. This is going to be an overwhelming transition in the sense that it's going to involve not just, you know, unplugging the coal power plant and plugging in a solar panel and then continuing with business as usual. It's going to change how we use energy and how much energy we use. And that's going to have implications for economic systems, political systems, and more. Just as the fossil fuel era marked a sharp and dramatic break from the agrarian way of life that preceded it, the post-fossil fuel era is going to be very, very different from what we've gotten used to over the last few decades. And there are, of course, a lot of issues to tease apart in all of that and lots to talk about. So I don't know which part of that transition you're interested in hearing about.
All of it, really, but maybe we don't have the time for today, but we will look into that. But I was reading about this energy scholar. I don't know if you've heard of him, Professor Vaclav Smil.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And he was saying that, you know, people are naive and they are enchanted by the idea of a rapid end to fossil fuels because they ignore the fact that it has typically taken 50 to 60 years for a widespread shift, you know, from one dominant fuel to another. He cited the example, you know, as coal gradually displaced wood, for example, it reached 5% of all fuel energy in 1840, but was still only about 50% by 1900. You know, and he also said there's a dearth of green alternatives to the fossil fuels used to make steel, cement or plastics, and replacing a global fossil fuel energy system that took an estimated $25 trillion to create over the 20th century. What do you think of his statement, basically?
I agree with it. Energy transitions are enormous enterprises and they take time. And up until this point, we have approached energy in an additive way. In other words, as we transitioned from wood to coal to oil to natural gas and nuclear, we were basically adding new sources of energy to old ones. Mm-hmm. We still use wood and biomass as a fuel globally and here in North America, all over the place. We still use coal. We still use oil. So what we're talking about with the transition to renewable energy or away from fossil fuels is a substitutive change, something entirely different from what we're used to. We're talking about switching away from our reliance on fossil fuels to whatever else is available, solar, wind, geothermal, biomass, et cetera, et cetera. And those energy sources have very different characteristics. Mm-hmm. They may not be available in the quantities that we've become accustomed to.
Yes,
so realistically, we believe at Post Carbon Institute that we're going to have to find ways during the transition to reduce our overall energy consumption very dramatically. One of the reasons for that is it's going to take energy to build all of the infrastructure needed for, let's say, a solar and wind energy economy. It takes energy to build solar panels and wind turbines. It takes energy to build electric cars or public transportation or however we're going to get around with electricity rather than with liquid fuels. Yeah. All of that requires energy for manufacturing and installation and so on. So where is that energy going to come from? Realistically, it's going to come from fossil fuels. But meanwhile, we're already using fossil fuels for all of these purposes. We're going to have to reduce our reliance on fossil fuels faster than we would ordinarily like to do in order to make the energy transition without a big pulse of extra carbon going into the atmosphere. And meanwhile, of course, these fossil fuels are depleting. I talked about the low-hanging fruit principle earlier. And as time goes on, the oil that we're using is getting to be either dirtier oil or more expensive oil or both. So if we don't want to be caught a decade or two from now, basically without enough energy to make the energy transition, then we're going to have to reduce our usage of fossil fuels, basically starting today, and make that reduction quite stringently, far more so than economists would like us to do, because of course their main priority is maintaining business as usual.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I don't think business as usual is going to be an option. One way or another, we are headed toward a very different energy economy. And if we step back and look at it and design it and plan for it, then I think we can still make that transition in a way that works for everyone. But if we just hope that the market takes care of it for us, hoping that solar panels will get cheaper and that somehow the magic of the market will solve all these problems, then I think we're headed for some pretty dark times.
What actually would you say are some of the most exciting things happening right now in clean energy?
Well, of course, the solar panels are becoming more efficient and cheaper, mm-hmm. Largely because of China's entry into the market.
Yep.
And not everyone sees that as a good thing because China has, you know, heavily subsidized its solar manufacturing. We're seeing energy storage get a lot cheaper, which is extremely important because, solar and wind are intermittent energy sources. So if we want to have a more predictable and controllable energy supply, we're going to have more storage. Battery storage, unfortunately, is still expensive and probably always will be, just the inherent nature of battery storage of energy. There are other ways of storing energy, and they're being researched now, including flywheels and compressed air and pumped hydro, pumping water uphill into reservoirs when there's a surplus of energy so that we can let the water flow back downhill and capture the energy through turbines when we need it. And on and on and on. All of these pathways are being pursued, and there are investors. So it's good to see all of this happening. The Elon Musk effect a few billionaires are really weighing in and subsidizing some of this research, and that's very good. But if again, right now the transition is going at only about a tenth the rate that needs to happen if we're going to avert some kind of economic crash from fossil fuel depletion and some kind of environmental crash from climate change. So we need more than the Elon Musks. We need we need everybody on board.
Yeah, because I was reading an article of which another billionaire actually, it was our Microsoft guy, and he was saying that, it shouldn't be the responsibility of billionaires, because obviously, he's doing a lot in the field of, promoting, change and, fighting against climate change and all that. Bill Gates, obviously, I'm talking about.
Yeah.
But, and someone asked him, what's the role of billionaires and all of this? And he said, yes, we do play a role, but it's governments. Governments are the ones that should be at the forefront of this fight and should not be, denying climate change, for example, or, shirking off responsibility that is theirs. Would you agree with that?
Well, I do agree with that. And at the same time, I hope by saying that he's not trying to let himself and the other billionaires off the hook.
I don't
I understand maybe he isn't, but I would just make the point that, an enormous amount of the world's capital is now locked up in the hands of the 1%, the extremely wealthy few hundred or few thousand people who hold as much wealth as the poorer half of humanity.
Yeah.
So I think those folks really do have the responsibility at this critical moment in human history to devote not just loose change, but really all of their wealth toward these pressing problems. One of those problems is, we've talked about fossil fuel depletion and climate change and debt and so on, but one of those problems is extreme economic inequality.
Yep.
And that has been a factor that has led to the demise of a number of civilizations in our past. And we are seeing levels of economic inequality today that are almost unprecedented. When we get to this level of inequality, the alarm bells should be ringing.
Do you think actually, just looking at the U.S., for example, do you think the U.S. has the right political priorities at the moment to deal with energy?
Well, at the moment, of course, we have a madman as president. So
Don't sugarcoat it, Richard.
No, I mean,
I fully agree with you. Sorry. Yeah. But anyway.
Yeah. The priorities of the U.S. federal government at this point are 180 degrees from where they should be. Mm-hmm. We have someone in charge of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency whose stated goal is to dismantle that agency and stop doing all of the things that, you know, for decades, environmentalists and politicians have worked to do, protecting endangered species, guaranteeing clean water and air, committing to climate change efforts, and so on. All of that's being undone. I mean, this is a crisis situation in the United States, and it's absolutely horrific to behold. The only good thing I can say about the situation is that our president is, in addition to being a madman, is also incredibly incompetent. And I think that incompetence is going to lead to his undoing sooner rather than later. And we'll see how that works out. But, you know, that's a very small silver lining to a very, very dark cloud, I have to say.
I was reading one of your past interviews, actually, and you mentioned that, you know, a lot of, well, I suppose far-right populists, they're actually riding the wave of public anxiety about slowing economic growth, you know, globalization, sure, job competition from overseas, you know, immigration, job competition at home. So, you know, it's an easy way to just deny climate science so they can promote more fossil fuel under the guise of promising more growth, right?
Yes, what we're seeing, not just in the United States, but in other countries that are shifting to right-wing authoritarian governments, what we're seeing is the result of the failure of political elites to understand the limits of the economy, mm-hmm, and the limits of our environment, and their failure to help us begin to adapt to those limits. The result of that failure is that we are seeing economic growth slowing, as we've talked about. We're seeing economic inequality increasing. And those two factors are resulting in profound unhappiness and a feeling of displacement among, yeah, a very large segment of the world's poor and middle class. Yeah. And because they don't have adequate leadership among the you know, sort of traditional elites, they're turning to these voices of you know, far right authoritarianism, and it's a tragedy. It's a historic tragedy, and it's going to lead us into a very, very terrible place if we don't somehow turn this around, and very quickly.
So I guess then, you know, what do you think the role of civil society is in this race to, I suppose, a zero carbon economy?
Well, right now it's a very big role, especially in some place like the United States, where the federal government has abdicated that role. Where we see the most hopeful things happening, it's at the local level in cities and communities, states, where NGOs are working with local governments to really get far out ahead of where national governments have made their priorities. Mm-hmm. In the United States, we see cities and states making climate commitments that are far in advance of even what the Obama administration was doing, much less the Trump administration. Yeah. So it's not as though nothing is happening. We are, in fact, seeing people wising up and doing what they can, but it's not necessarily at the most visible kind of national or international level. It's, you have to sort of get down into the weeds to see the more or the most hopeful efforts that are going on. And you know, when you do that, you realize that really the local community is in many ways the most effective place to work, the most effective place to get involved. That's because, you know, the people who are most impacted by these efforts are the ones who are making the decisions and helping them along. Yeah. I think people have gotten understandably distressed at how distant federal governments national governments are from ordinary people. And as we get involved in our local communities to build alternative economic institutions, to build renewable energy infrastructure, to find ways to, you know, get around the terrible inequality that we're facing, you know, people are able to participate in those efforts and enjoy the results of them much more and feel more of an ownership of them. It's not, you know, somebody off in a national capital doing this to them. It's them accomplishing something with their neighbors and friends. It's far more effective.
Is this the concept of community resilience, which is something, one of the topics covered by Post Carbon Institute? Is this what you're talking about?
Absolutely. That's really the core of it right there. Resilience is an important word because it means the ability to absorb change and bounce back, to maintain basic functions in the face of disruption. Well, we have plenty of disruption headed our way, no matter how you look at it. So how do we build more resilience, especially at the local level? Well, it's all the things we've been talking about. It's especially building social capital, so people know their neighbors and are more accustomed to, you know, solving problems together with their friends and neighbors, rather than just assuming that somehow those problems will be solved by this political party or that leader in a distant national capital. And when we build that resilience, we find that not only is our community better able to handle disruption and change, but people are much happier in whatever situation they have.
How does your own life reflect sort of the things that you advocate? And I'm not trying to interrogate you or anything, but I just read that you and your wife, you know, you've been trying to develop as much self-sufficiency as possible in your daily lives. Maybe you could just share that with us just for some inspiration, actually.
Well, sure. I mean, we've been working on this for almost 20 years now. We have a quarter acre suburban lot and with a little house, a little old 1950s ranch house. And we the first thing we did when we got the place was super insulate the house and put solar panels on the roof and solar hot water. And we tore up the lawn in the backyard and turned it into 25 fruit and nut trees and then a dozen garden beds. We have chickens living with us, and they provide us with eggs and companionship. And so, you know, we're not completely self-sufficient. We go to the grocery store. We still have a car, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But we've done what we could, and it's, you know, I have to say, it's very satisfying. You know, we have a lifestyle that I think is within reach of most suburban American households. And yet, we live far more lightly on the land than is the average in North America. And I think we have a quality of life that is probably enviable even by people with much higher incomes.
Agreed. And, you know, it's the little things that kind of, you know, get you started in the right direction, right? I mean, just maybe investing in energy-saving appliances, for example. That's another thing that, you know, all of us should do. Yeah, it's more expensive at the start, but, you know, in the long run, it will save you a lot.
Right. Yeah, well, it's not, you know, the energy transition is not going to be paid for by national governments. It's going to be, we're all going to be paying for it one way or another, you know, whether it's an electric car or solar panels or energy saving appliances, as you say, you know, it's going to require investment and we can each be part of that reinvestment just in the choices we make. You know, you're going to buy some kind of appliances over the course of your lifetime, even if it's only light bulbs and the computer and whatever else you use. With each of those purchasing decisions, there's an opportunity to look for, well, what's the most energy efficient, the most sustainable choice to make?
Yeah. And just to conclude, Richard, maybe you can leave us with some essential reading on, you know, moving towards a carbon-free economy, or, you know, just how to simplify our lives.
Oh, well, you know, I can't suggest anything better, I'm afraid, than what I've already mentioned. Our post-carbon website, and particularly our book, our renewable future. I mean, it is partly a higher level look at the energy transition in terms of what solar and wind are capable of, what the transition is likely to look and feel like. But it's also a lot about our individual choices and our individual role in that transition. So I think it's a pretty helpful document.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much, Richard.
It's been a pleasure, Juliet.
If you'd like to find out more about the Post Carbon Institute, you can visit postcarbon.org. And you can also visit Richard's website, richardheinberg.com. That's RichardHeinberg.com. You've been listening to Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.